there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Well, welcome, folks, to episode 3,563. We are live today, and we will have Kyle, the Backwoods Butcher, on with us in just a minute. We're going to be talking about processing your own livestock at home, either for personal use or for resale, and the need to have less regulation and interference from the Department of Making You Sad in doing that so that we can actually start to provide better protein for everybody everywhere. Because if we could get around the government issues, you know, I think there's plenty of people out there that would be happy to be doing some of this this husbandry and taking care of these animals and raising much higher quality product if they had a market for it. And it is the processing where it all breaks down. So we'll have Kyle on to talk about that. I've had him on before. He's a great guy. In just a minute, we'll bring him on. Until then, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor day number one today is a busted ass website from John Bush. That's right, the Freedom Trinity webinar. In all seriousness, this is a great webinar series. Something's wrong with the website today, but you can still sign up for it and take it. It's just a display issue. All the content's there. And you can learn how to use things like private membership associations and other structures to allow you to do a lot of what we're talking about today with Kyle. Get around the Department of Making You Sad. This is a great webinar. You can take it for free. All you got to do is sign up for it. So check it out today. You can find a link in the show notes, or if you're on the video right now, there's actually a link down in the video notes below. Next up today, life is too short for average. We're going to be talking about doing delicious things with meat today. I'm going to tell you one of the most delicious things you can do with meat, especially red meat, is to make biltong out of it. Anton from Anton's Lawn, Land of Biltong, he knows how to make it the right way. He is straight out of South Africa himself. He makes it the traditional way. Man, I love his biltong so much. He actually pays me at least part of his sponsorship with a shipment of biltong every 2 weeks. I have the flavor of coriander and Worcestershire in my mouth. I told Kyle during the lead up to this that I should have had some here to torture him with. But fortunately for him, I finished what I had before we got on air. But you should definitely check out Anton's Land of Biltong and try the original biltong for yourself, the traditional South African style. With that, I am happy to bring our special guest on, Kyle, also known as the Backwoods Butcher. And I didn't want to butcher your last name, but is it Pinault? Is that the right way to say it?
Peralt. We did this last time, too.
Yeah, we did.
The last episode, I was like, we did this. I was like, yeah, everyone goes to pronounce it the French way, and it's like, I shoot animals in the face. You don't pronounce the T. I'm not fancy.
Speaking of the last time, before we dig into this, tell people a little bit about yourself because maybe they didn't hear that episode.
Absolutely. So my name is Kyle. If I am on social media, I am the Backwoods Butcher. I am the owner of a custom exempt butcher shop in northern New Hampshire. We also raise heritage pigs with production pigs in there. Trying to come up with the best meat quality I possibly can. So I have my hands in a lot of different activities going on. So we process livestock and wild game for a lot of locals around here, so they're able to feed their families and help get stuff in the freezer for them.
And you know, you were on the show, I guess, somewhere around a year ago, something like that, maybe a little longer.
I think it was right around a year. I looked at it. Yeah. It was right before SRF again.
Yeah, so it was recent, but not immediately recent, right? So,
right.
What's it been like since then? How has your shop grown since the last time you were on the show?
Just consistency. Like my consistency of business has definitely picked up to where I have a large group of regular customers that come to me quite a bit. I have very recently found out I have made a name for myself when it comes to processing black bear in New Hampshire, mostly because no one else wants to do it. But we've just been growing little bit at a time. We've been going for about 4 years now, and it's one of those things. We didn't take out any loans to start it. We started it from scratch and have just been chipping away at it ever since. So I do everything bullet to freezer. So as we grow one thing at a time. It's here's a new piece of equipment, or here's a new strategy on how we do this. Switching up cut sheets to make everything work. And honestly, it's been working out really well, and my customers seem to be really happy with it. So I can't complain too much about that.
Has most of your growth been in the game market, or processing other people's stuff, or processing your own stuff for sale?
It's mostly livestock. Processing livestock for people, that has boomed. Like I said, I now have a nice certain group of regular customers that I get quite a bit, and those get I get referrals from those people. So it's my calendar is pretty much stocked all the way through the rest of the year going into the next year, which as a butcher in the service industry, that is something that you absolutely want to have. You want to have your calendar full so you know what you're doing from week to week. But again, in the wild game sector too, I've absolutely grown a ton when it comes to that. I've already done, I checked in my 9th bear yesterday already, and hound season started Monday. So okay. We've been picking up pretty quick already.
Why does nobody want to do bear?
They're greasy suckers.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
It's tough, because the way I always explain it to people is, when it comes to wild game, I can't tell you how many customers I get that are shocked or like surprised when I hand them a cut sheet and I go, hey, let's fill out your cut sheet. And they go, what do you mean? I give you my animal and then you give me back some steaks stuff with hair on it. And I go, no, that's not how this works. I do this professionally all year round. I'm taking time out of doing livestock to do wild game.
Yeah.
So if you want specialty cuts, if you want stuff cut a certain way, different amounts of things, we can make that happen. So bears are very similar to processing pigs. They're fatty. They're built very similar. They break down very similar. They can be replaced with pork, or like pork can be replaced with bear in many recipes, because you have to cook bear all the way through. It has to be at 165. If not, you're going to get trichinosis, which the cliff notes.
And I would actually say your risk of trichinosis from bear is higher than
exponentially higher. Yeah.
Like you eat a bear, you're probably going to get.
Yeah. The chances of getting trichinosis from eating undercooked bear is almost 100. The chances from getting it from undercooked pork, especially nowadays, the production market has absolutely annihilated trichinosis out of it. Again, you might run a risk getting it from a family farm or something like that. Yeah. Not very high. But the cliff notes on that, it's a little parasite. If you eat it, the eggs dissolve in your stomach acid, and then you feel like you have the worst flu you've ever had for like a month, because all of those parasites are leaching into every single joint and muscle in your body and laying eggs. And then after that, nothing. There is no bad results from having it. If anyone eats you, they then have trichinosis. It's still not very fun.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I looked it up when I got into curing meats on, you know, what was the risk from pork, especially if it was frozen -5 for X number of days or whatever. And it turned out something like 95% of trichinosis cases in America since the 60s has been bear meat.
Oh, for sure. I think it's bear and mountain lion. Bear and mountain lion are the highest ones.
Yeah. 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 Go ahead.
No, but it's people just don't want to process them because they're greasy, and a lot of the deer shops that pop up around here, because it happens every year, someone's uncle taught them to cut up deer 20 years ago, and they're like, hey, I'm going to put a piece of plywood in the shop and cut up people's deer. They don't want to deal with bears because they're just greasy and a pain in the butt.
I've only ever done one in my life, and what it actually reminded me less than pig was more like a giant raccoon.
Yes,
because it's very similar greasier fat. In a different way than pig. Like pig's greasy, but bear is like a different level of greasy. Like there's dirty from working in the dirt, and there's dirty from working with tires.
Yes,
right.
If
and
you're
kind
skinning
of
out a bear,
is like tire dirt, but moved into the grease world with a bear.
If you're skinning out a bear and it's above 70 degrees, that fat is rendering on the hook.
Yeah.
I have a video out there somewhere of me skinning out a bear, and it was a fatty one. And and you can just see the fat dripping off the back of it. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah. So can we talk about, like, we want to talk a little bit about restrictions and how the government interferes with people that are like, oh, I don't know, trying to do what humans have done for tens of thousands of years, just turn delicious animals into delicious meat, right? How could less restrictions on animal processing not just help, like, individuals like you, but the community as a whole, preppers, homesteaders, Virgin Ag, all of it?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is it's like, so for just like a cliff note for anyone who doesn't know, if you raise an animal and you want to then sell that animal in cuts, so like say just sell, here's a package of ribeyes, here's a package of pork chops, something like that. All of those animals have to go through a USDA inspected facility, which depending on where you are, could be huge, could be small. Up here in New Hampshire where I'm at, the one I worked at was a very small family owned shop. They were fantastic. Besides the fact that we had to have a USDA inspector there to make sure they do everything. So essentially there is a USDA inspector at every one of these facilities that has to go through and make sure the shop is clean and every animal that is walking into the kill pens that day is standing and healthy and moving healthy. We'll put air quotes on that one.
Yeah.
And then they have to inspect the carcass, make sure there's no parasites, make sure there's no hair or feces or anything on the carcass before it goes in the cooler. Great. That's fine and dandy. But any butcher worth their salt can absolutely do that exact same thing and more. I have seen so many instances where it's like they're just checking a box, sending stuff into the cooler that absolutely should not be going in the cooler. Because it's not a healthy animal, or it's not something that people should absolutely eat. And again, I always go back to, I'm not going to name names, but there was a farm that we worked with that would go and buy old dairy cows from the auction, old retired dairy cows, put them out on pasture. And these animals have been eating a very high protein diet, eating grain, like in milking stalls and stuff like that. You put those animals on pasture, they have no idea what they're doing, and they're not getting the nutrients they're used to. So in order, per USDA regulations, in order for something to be grass-fed, it doesn't have to be grass-fed its entire life. It only has to be grass-fed for a certain period of time. I think it's something insane like 8 months. It's like something really dumb like that.
Yeah.
So these animals would come in, and they would be... They wouldn't have an ounce of fat on them. They'd be tough, and they would just be gross. And there, on multiple occasions, we'd put these animals through. We'd get them hung up to go in the cooler. The fat, what would be fat is just slime on the outside, and it's just gross. And the inspector would come in and goes, well, there's a tiny piece of hair up there on one of the joints that's never going to see a commercial, like a tray.
Yeah.
Once you pull that off, that thing's good to go. And my boss would be like, absolutely not. This thing's not entering the cooler. I literally just pulled you in here just to hear you say this so I can have disgust for you.
Yeah.
And then we take it and throw the entire thing in the rendering barrel. And it's like, that's what you're passing? As someone who's trying to keep people safe from eating healthy food that's good for them, that's what you're going to say, put the stamp of approval. This is good to go. So it's just so many instances of that. It's like any butcher worth their salt can tell you what's healthy, what's not, and can make that call.
I mean, on top of it, these are federal employees, and the processing facility has to pay their salary.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's like, because they have to be there all the time, right?
It's not even that. There is a certain amount paid to the government to have the inspector there. That inspector is not getting paid what
I got you.
To be paid to the government.
What I'm saying is we're paying the cost to the government of that employee. That's
exactly
what we're paying, right? Your employer's cost to you is not what you get paid. You're paying the salary as though you're the federal government. Yeah.
Right. And like I see that comment down there from John Lee, like about the USDA facilities being disease factories.
Yeah.
It got all of a sudden, like there was a huge wake up call to people when COVID hit, because guess what? All the process facilities that put through 5,000 head of cattle a day and have a couple thousand people working there in dank, cold, wet environments where things like that love to grow, all of a sudden they were completely shut down. Yeah. No one could work. No one could process. It was a running joke here because my wife's an ICU nurse. So she was, I forget the name of the employee. I don't know what it was, but butchers and slaughtermen and stuff like that were critical employees. Oh, essential employees. As a nurse, she was an essential employee. But as a butcher, I was a critical employee. So I'd come in, she'd be dealing with COVID patients all day. I'd be like, it's tough being a critical employee.
I mean, I also just think, like, if we got out of the way of people, if the government would get out of the way of people, we would have a lot more access to high-quality protein.
Right.
The reason I will not, let's say, do pastured chicken here isn't because I can't do it. It isn't because I can't do the work. It's because there's not enough money in it for me to make doing the processing worth doing to fall in that on-farm processing exemption, right? Like, I would run 400 a year, make about $10 a bird. It's $4,000. I can't do that to make $4,000.
No, because you also have to deal with chickens, and that sucks.
Yeah, right? If I could just say, hey, I'm going to take these 400 chickens, throw them on a trailer, take them down and have them processed, I probably would. And I'd have, and just with next door, I'd have them all sold every year before I put one on grass.
Absolutely.
But and would I do that for $4,000? Yeah, sure. And the people that process for me when I have them process for me, would they like 400 birds for me to process? Sure, because I know you don't want to do it. But if you're completely set up to do poultry,
right,
and you're paying people, you have employees, like a facility I used to work at, it's no big deal. But it's untenable. There's no way to do it that makes sense here at all. Right. And then you can take that and, like, you know, maybe I would do 10 Dorpers a year, something like that, right? It's just not worth it. It's not worth it if I have to deal with if I don't have – I don't need a sale barn. I don't want a commodity sale situation. That doesn't help me.
Right.
I want to sell direct to my customer, but if I can't – easily without doing all kinds of rigmarole, just have processing taken care of, it's not worth it. Especially, like you said, if somebody wants, well, I want lamb chops. Well, now I'm done. Like, there is a way around it with the state facilities here where if I sell you the whole animal and you go sign for it and they process for you, but that's too much trouble. But if you want to sell, like, pieces, parts, like, I have 10 different stores that we used to sell duck eggs through that if I had chops and grind, like you're saying, strip, loin, whatever, I could sell, and it would be worth doing. I could probably make a $40,000 or $50,000 extra a year off this one piece of property here.
Of course, and it's like you will always make.
If I can't access processing easily, it's not worth doing.
And you'll always make more on cuts. You will always 100% of the time make more on selling cuts than you will a whole or a half animal. And the other thing about it is, it's like, hey, guess what? If you open up those restrictions. Now, and it's, I know there are a ton of USDA facilities where it's like, it is a mom and pop shop, where it is like they also have, and I'm not going after these people. It's, they shouldn't have to deal with the USDA in order to sell this stuff. And it's like now all of a sudden that shop is now just custom exempt or whatever. And all that money is staying local. It's not going to all the letter agencies to get spread off to wherever it needs to go. All that money staying local. More will probably pop up. More people will start raising products like that because, hey, guess what? Now all your meat's coming from a local spot. It's being processed at a local spot. And all that money stays in the community.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about, a permaculture principle, we call it economic entropy.
Right.
Right. So the money that should be in this circular economy is being bled out of these small local economies that can least afford it. Like money bleeding out of Dallas or money bleeding out of Boston doesn't matter because plenty's coming back in.
Right.
You start bleeding money out of a place like Azle, Texas, and you're just draining this little, wonderful little small town, but you're draining it because all the money's going to Walmart, right? All the money's going to Tom Thumb. All the money's going to Purdue. All the money's going to Tyson. All of it going to Conagra on the food side and 100 other places. And this would be one place that, like, this shouldn't even be a thing. Like, the way this country was founded, what it was built on, the idea, like, I'm pretty sure our founders would have put something in the Bill of Rights about this if they could have even conceived, right, that this would ever be a thing. Like, Bill's not going to be able to have Frank take care of his pig. Like, I don't even think, like, their brain would have just cracked. Like, they would have said, well, yeah, fuck it. Stay with the king. Why are we even doing this if this is going to be the result?
Well, and it's like the way to look at it, like the way I look at it from a somewhat libertarian standpoint of just like, hey, guess what? Because I the argument back and forth is, and I will get to that question. I did see it.
No, don't worry about it. You keep going.
People will look at it and go, oh, well, people are going to take advantage of that, and they're not going to follow the rules and regulations that are kind of just laid out, and people are going to get sick, and people are going to do this. And it's go, hey, everybody, you're all adults. If you show up to a dude's house that's selling pork chops, and he's got three cars that don't start in his yard, and the pigs are being held in by pallets and hope, maybe don't buy his pork chops. But if you go to a person that has an established shop, you go look at their farm, you see their livestock, you talk to the person, and you start buying it, and you don't get sick, hey, guess what? Go support that guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's the weak will get weaned out 110%. So, and I did see that question about custom exempt. So
No. If you want to ask a question, do it exactly like what you're seeing here in the live stream, and we will star you, and then Kyle and I will get to you after we're done with the main body of the interview. That way we don't segue off sideways. Anyway, where I was going to go with that is, you mentioned that every year people are like, hey, my uncle taught me to cut up a deer 30 years ago, and I'm going to throw a piece of plywood in my shop and be a deer processor. Does it ever strike you as crazy that, like, if I want to right now, going into deer season here, I could do that. I could put an ad out on Nextdoor, Craigslist, whatever. I process deer meat. Some Billy Bob goes down to Kerrville. It's like a 7-hour drive. Mm-hmm. Throws his deer in the back of the truck with no eyes.
Yeah.
Cruises with a dead stiff deer all the way to my place. Drops it off in my garage. I throw up two sawhorses and a piece of plywood. Cut up his deer meat, give it back to him 3 days later. No oversight whatsoever. This is completely legal. This is completely legal. Yeah. But if the same guy lives down the road from me, loads up two Dorper rams, puts them in a trailer alive, brings them here, and I pop them in the head with a .38 and process them for him, I could be sent to jail for that.
Yeah.
Now, isn't there like – doesn't the brain just kind of go, wait, I don't understand this. Like – because I've seen dudes literally drive 7 hours with a dead deer with skin on in mm-hmm. the back of their pickup truck, and their solution to the temperature being 70 degrees is they take two bags of ice and stick it in the chest cavity.
Yeah.
And somehow those guys don't die, by the way.
No.
Right? So how much risk is there in me processing your ram or your pig? It doesn't make any sense.
No, people, like, they make it out that it's like, and again, in different scenarios, it's absolutely true, where it's like, if you did that with a pig, you're going to get sick, more than likely. Meat's fairly resilient. Like, animals are fairly resilient in storage and stuff like that. Like, again, they're blowing it out of proportion and making it like, oh, my God, if you don't go through us, you're all going to die, and it's going to be awful. And it's like, that's not the case. That's not the case at all. You're just trying to get corner of the market and make it so we have to go to you in order to get our food. The fact that there are caps in most states on how much homesteads and farms can make is insane. Like, it is absolutely insane. New Hampshire no longer does, but for a while, you could only make like $45,000 off your homestead. Like, if you made any more, that was illegal. And it's like, how does that make sense?
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense at all. It is weird the way we've created these laws that have these carve-outs for things that are actually far more likely to cause a problem than the things we don't. But, you know, the thing is that Cargill or Tyson, right, or Smithfield isn't making money off deer meat.
No.
So it's not seen as a threat, right? They don't see it as a threat. So that tells you the law is not about safety at all.
Well, the other hard part about it is it's like there's no one to do it. Like, yeah. Butchering is a dying art. It's a dying breed that not a lot of people sign up for. Like, that's always the running joke. Like, I would love to hire someone. I'm not making, like, it's just not financially sound for me to hire someone at the moment. Yeah. But it's like, what kind of an ad is that? Hey, do you want to work super long hours, be covered in blood, soaking wet in the colds? Then come work for me. It's like, yeah that's.
You get paid less than you would driving a truck for Walmart.
Right. And hey, guess what? You're not actually going to be doing the actual job for probably about a year and a half while you're in training and while you're going through the apprenticeship and everything like that. No one wants to put the time and work in to do it the right way.
Yeah. I'm just communicating with our audience here. I'm trying to make sure we're clear on a question. Let's talk a little bit about ways people can start to raise their own livestock. Because at least one thing we do still have, if you raise it and you're willing to process it, that's pretty clean everywhere. I know you're big on pigs. Are there some things people could do to prepare to start raising pigs? Because I think they're one of the real, what's the word I'm like diamond in the rough or something, like, or a missed opportunity. People don't understand how much meat you can raise in a relatively condensed period of time. You don't get anywhere near the meat off of a pig that you do off a cow. But a cow's big. A cow can step on you and kill you. Not that a pig can't when it gets really big. But in general, the slaughter size for most homestead pigs is 250 pounds. You can raise pigs in 8 months versus 18 to properly finish. And sometimes some cattle, like you mentioned, some of the problems with like grass-fed not really working out. Like part of it is like this animal's not done yet.
Right.
They don't. I don't know if you know this. Cows don't read calendars.
They sure don't.
So they don't know, hey, I'm supposed to die today, and I'm supposed to be all ready to go, and I'm supposed to be nicely marbled. They don't know that. So sometimes that cow needs to go 20, 24 months.
Up here in New Hampshire, it's a minimum.
Yeah.
Like, you shouldn't bring a cow in if you want it perfectly marbled and at weight until 20, 24 months. Because half the year, you're feeding it, just keep weight on it. Grass-fed is a geographic term.
It is.
I am saying that. I'm preaching it from the rooftops. You are not going to raise a amazing grass-fed animal in less than 24 to 30 months in New England.
Well, we can legitimately pull it off in 18 to 20 here because we have grass year-round, right? In the right part of the state, because there's other ones. It's plenty warm out, but the grass is brown.
Right.
Right. The grass turned itself into straw.
It's a geographic term.
Yeah. So, but pigs really do have like this great niche, I think, for the homestead size production. What are some things people could do to kind of get into that world?
Pigs are like, I'm not going to say pigs are easy. They're easier than cattle. if you want to get into pigs, all you need is a quarter acre, even less really. Like if you want to be super humane, give them a quarter acre, pick up two pigs and just hard panel the heck out of it. They don't take much. And when I started the shop, I did a lot of mobile processing too. So just showing up at people's farms and looking at 300 pound Yorkshires in these areas where it's like, wow, you fit this thing in here? Like pigs adapt and overcome 100% of the time. That's the reason that they're a problem. Like feral pigs are a problem because they adapt and overcome everything. Yeah. So if you have a small plot of land, if it's wooded, if it's open, if it does not matter, as long as it's not underwater, and even that is kind of like you can get away with it sometimes. If you put up some fencing and some electric fence, you can get pigs. You can get yourself some Yorkshires, which are the big pink production pigs. You can have a 300 pound pig in 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's very quick, very easy. But the biggest thing I would tell people is, fencing. Spend the time, spend the money on your fencing. Though pigs are like the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, where they had to move them into the confined area because they would just keep testing the electric fence.
Yeah.
Pigs will continually test the electric fence.
Yep.
No matter what. And they will try and find a way to get out of there.
Yeah. Once they put that pink nose against that wire, mm-hmm. though, they get a whole new respect for it. You gotta feel a little bit bad for them.
No, of course.
Right, because the first time they contact the wire, it's inevitably a nose.
Oh, yeah.
And if you've ever had one, like, pop you in the wrist or something, like, it hurts. I can only imagine, right, the snout.
I do feel bad a little bit until I, like, we, I haven't had to deal with it. I'm going to knock on wood for a minute. I haven't had to deal with it for a couple of weeks. We had to move our feeder piglets. We had to wean them off, and I'd move them into a separate pen, and they were just destroying their electric every day, so I'd have to go through and readjust. And by, like, the fourth day,
yeah.
Don't know if people know this, when you do it, once again, they're still going to test the fence, especially if they've been walking all over it and grounding it up. So all of a sudden, when you redo it for about a half hour, you just hear a symphony of squeals as those little fuckers trying to test the fence where they were trying to get through the floor. Oh, yeah, so you'll just be walking through doing chores, and you're, it's like, all right, fence is hot.
You know, and you mentioned, like, how small land you can actually raise them on it. So what I'm about to say, I am not advocating what I'm about to say, but I'm just making a point. One of the coolest, like, mainstream media productions, if it's even mainstream media, that I've ever seen is Wartime Farm, that came out of the BBC. And it's about how the British people dealt with things during World War II on the countryside. And they talk about pig clubs, and they raise these huge pigs, these giant-ass pigs, in basically a pigsty, like literally an area a little bit bigger than my office. And because pigs, like, they're known as being dirty animals and all, but they don't poop where they sleep.
No.
So they pick a spot, and that's where they crap, and then you can shovel it out and use it as fertilizer. And these families would go together, and they would raise a pig on slop. And the pig never would come out of that area. No. And they'd raise these, like you said, 300-400-pound animals in a single season, feeding them all the way. Like, what it would do is, like, four families would get together.
Right.
And they would take all their waste and then boil it down to slop to feed the pig with. And then it was so restrictive at the time because there was a war on that they only got half the pig.
Right.
Right. So they were able to do all that work for half a pig split between three or four families. If they can do that, then we can definitely raise, like you said, two on a quarter acre. It's not even a challenge.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I just shoot myself in the foot, and I have made huge pastures that I have to worry about pigs breaking electric and having to go around and just do all the fence checks. But again, it's how I want to raise my animals. And it's, again, for meat quality. I think a pig should be able to run around. It should be able to root. It should be able to run up and down hills and pastures. Cause guess what? Meat's muscle. It needs to build that muscle. And in order to do that, it needs to have space to run around and do it.
Yeah, and I think happy animals produce better product.
Oh, of course.
Right?
You know, of course.
Mark Shepard's famous for saying they have one bad day. And I remember when I was on a project with him, I said, you know, I think you should change the way you phrase that because they don't have a bad day. They have a bad second.
They have a bad second, exactly.
They have a bad second. Well, they don't even know. Done.
Hopefully it's a second.
If
it's not a second, you screwed up, and that's your fault. And you have to live with that, which I do sometimes, and it's not fun.
Yeah, it happens. Like, no matter how hard you try, like one of the people I felt the worst for in my life, we did a chicken processing class here, and I felt bad for everybody because I literally put this chicken to sleep. Like, it, you know, when they flip at the end, it didn't even do that. It bled out and it never moved. And that was like the standard that was set. And you have like one student that cuts the trachea, but not the, and the thing sitting there flailing, like, felt so bad for, but we all will have times when we're going to put an animal down one way or another and things don't go quite right.
Right.
And I think it's bad for the moment, but I think it's good in a way because it keeps us humble.
Of course.
It keeps us in touch with it. Like, Joel Salatin one time said if he's doing a lot of processing and he stops feeling something, he doesn't process for a few days.
Yeah. No.
Like, you should feel something when you take an animal's life or you become. And I think that's actually part of the problem with the large system we're talking about, too. Those people work in those factories, those processing factories, they don't have any feeling at all for that animal anymore because I think to work in that environment for that long, you have to develop like this cold, callous nature. And it's not good.
In some of those big facilities, you almost don't need people anymore. The people are just there because they kind of have to be. They kind of have to have the veil of, all right, no, it's still people doing this. They're so
automated. You have to clean it. Like, after it's all messed up, you got to clean the hooks and shit, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's like, it's, again, I absolutely agree it is a very humbling experience. And again, I do quite a bit. I put through quite a bit through the shop, and it's one of those situations where, like, I had a beef drop off today, and it's being able to gauge the situation. Like, because again, I didn't grow up in any of this. My mom worked at a bank. Okay. Like, I just came into this later in life. And I didn't have a ton of livestock experience until I really started hitting this hard. And talk about smoking the whole pack. Like, literally just started, started the custom exempt facility and just really started going to town with it. But it's trial by fire.
Yeah.
You learn how to understand animals super quick. Like the one I had today, I asked the right questions beforehand. I'm like, what's the temperament? How's it like? And the guy goes, well, he likes me. He doesn't like anyone else. And it's like, cool, not getting it with the handgun. I'm going to grab something bigger. And then I'm still like, all right, let me just kind of gauge it. Let me go out and check it out. Okay, let's open the door. He's just standing there looking at me. All right, still don't really trust it. Going to grab the 410.
Yeah.
Get it out to where we're going to pop it. Open the gate with the 410. It starts wheeling around the trailer. And I'm like, yeah, I'm really glad I got the 410 because yeah. There's no way I would have got this with the 45.
Lose like, an arm is what you're going to get there, right?
Exactly. So it's like, it's gauging what you need to do and what the animal's going to do. And it's you're going to pick up on that. But if you lose the sense of, oh, that's heavy what I just did. I just did something that I took a life. Like, there's no other way around it. There's no other way you can look at it. You took a life.
Yeah.
Now, you can either accept that or dwell in it, preferably a little bit of both. But it's what you do with that after the fact.
I agree. For me, actually, that was the hardest part of adjusting. I did grow up with it. I butchered my first deer, like, all the way through on my own when I was, like, 11 years old.
Right.
But it wasn't until much older that I took the life of an animal that was captive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like, shooting a deer that's trying to get away and has every advantage over you. Like, it was always, like, there's a certain emotion to it because, you're still taking a life. But, like, okay, so I've raised this animal, and now I'm going to hang it upside down and cut its throat. That was a lot tougher, even though, like, just a chicken or something, you know? And I think I do think it's good that we don't lose that connection. I know you are big on pigs, though. Is there anything you really wish that you had known before you started doing pigs?
The fencing thing. That's the one I preach. I'm like, spend the money, spend the time on fencing.
Yeah.
But no, the one thing that I will absolutely say is do your research on breeds.
Mm.
For whatever you want, wherever you are, like, there is a specific pig that works for your area. Again, I have taken an interesting route with breeding heritage genetics into my production pigs to try to come up with something with better meat quality. But with that also, they produce more fat and they grow hair. Because guess what? 6 months out of the year, we're in a frozen wasteland. So it's being able to work with that. But again, like if you're a little further south than me, like if you're in New York, Pennsylvania, where you have like lesser winters, you can get away with raising Yorkshires all year round. Like, just build them a shelter. They're fine. So whatever is going to work for you in the time scale that you're working with. I have accepted the fact that my pigs grow out longer. And because of that, my price point's a little bit higher because I have to equate for that. So it's just doing the research, talk to your butchers, talk to whoever's going to be processing it, and that, if anything, that will be my closing statement on pigs. When you get the pig, call your processor, like the day, and set your date. Mm. Because what's tough is a lot of producers are booked out 2 years or a year. I am very different in the fact where I try to keep some wiggle room in my calendar to, like, I kind of Robin Hood around here in northern New Hampshire where it's like, I can't get in anywhere else. All right, come here, I'll take you. Like, I do try to keep a little wiggle room for people.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you're small enough that you can do that.
Right.
And probably not all the time, though. Like, I'm sure there's times where you do back up, and I'm sorry. And I guess the one good thing is, like, if I shoot a deer or a bear and I don't want to self-process it, I need it done now.
Right.
If I have a pig and I'm like, I want to get it processed next week, and you're like, I don't have anything for 3 weeks, I just keep the pig alive longer and stuff feed him and put some more fat on.
Well, right, like right now is tough. Like I put a beef in today that's going to be hanging for 2 weeks because I'm going to be headed down to SRF on Monday. Yeah. And I wanted something hanging for when I get back. But then I'm also am right in the middle of hound season. So I've got bears coming in and out, handful of archery deer coming in and out. I'm trying to get everything processed and cut and ready to pick up before I leave, but then also plan everything out so when I get back, I have an animal to process and then an animal to process the next week. Like just gauging everything. So yeah, next month is pretty crammed together already.
For people out there that are having trouble finding a place to get meat processed, can you talk about maybe how they can get started doing their self-processing? Because I totally get somebody that raises a cow and is like, I'm going to take this thing on a trailer or pay my buddy with a trailer to take it down and have it taken care of. Because we talked about this last time you were on. It is a big animal. It is a
lot of work.
It is a huge undertaking. Biggest thing I ever processed in my life, and I had to do it on the ground and take it out in pieces, when I went on a self-guided elk hunt and I shot a spike bull elk. And that is a much smaller animal than a fully finished freaking beef cow.
Right.
And it's still huge. And it was more work after I killed it than it was up until I killed it. It was a couple days to get this animal out. And it wasn't even that far from where a vehicle could be gotten to relative to where I was at. So when you're sitting here looking at a 1,000-pound or greater animal, like, I get it. But sheep, pigs, lambs, like, everything south of the cow is something that reasonably can be done at home.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, absolutely. Like, if you're starting to raise sheep, you can absolutely do them at home. You can do them at home with very, very minimal effort. Like, well, effort probably isn't the right word. It's funny because the way I describe it is sheep are the easiest things to learn to slaughter. Pigs are the easiest thing to learn to break down. Lambs are always just a little bit weirder because everyone wants the nice lamb chops and you have to deal with chining the bones and dealing with all that. Whereas a pig, you can just debone that whole thing and you have great boneless pork chops and stuff like that. I think the biggest thing that I would do is, once again, do your research. Like, there are 1,000 YouTube channels out there, mine included, that has full breakdowns of animal processing. Take the time to learn it. If you have someone local that is a friend of yours or knows a friend, and it's like, hey, do you mind if I shadow you for a day? Like, I want to start doing this for myself. The majority of us are super nice. Like, unless you're like, hey, I also want to open a butcher shop like 3 doors down. Can I shadow you?
Yeah, probably that's different. Right. That's,
but if you're like, hey, man, like, I know you're slammed. I know you're busy. Hey, can I work with you for free for a week? Or like, because they'll take that. They'll take that free work for sure. So it's just learn the process a little bit more. Get a little more information on it, whether it be YouTube or in person. And then just do it. Like, that's the hard part. That's the best information I can give you. You just got to do it. And I'm also here to tell you, I promise you, you're going to screw it up. The first time, you're going to screw up something.
You're going to be skinning and you're going to take off like half a back strap with the hide.
Exactly.
You're going to go to hang it up and you're going to cut the tendon and the damn thing's going to fall off. It's going to happen.
You're going to cut yourself at least once,
good
or bad. Hell, I still do it. I cut myself the other day. The only thing that stopped it was the nail bed. It was on TikTok Live, too, and I had to be like, oh, hey, I'll be right back, guys.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just prepare yourself for it. Like, this isn't like I'm going to go pull the alternator out of the truck. I've never done that before, but here's a YouTube video on it. Like, watch a bunch of YouTube videos and understand what you're doing. You're taking an animal's life. Then you have to store that animal because that animal is going to be your food. So it has to be safely done. You have to have a good setup and somewhat understand how to break that animal down. But what I will tell you is burger saves everything. If you screw up a chop, toss it in the sausage pile. If you screw up a roast, guess what? More sausage. And if it's like, oh man, this was a nice tender cut that I screwed up, like, I don't want to toss it in the burger, there's a thing called stir fry.
Yeah.
Now you got a couple packages of stir fry.
Yeah.
Like, there are ways to fix everything. And if you think you're going to go into it and go, hey, I watch his TikTok or I watch his YouTube, he does great work. Like, oh, I can do that. I believe you, and I agree with you that you can. But it will not be the first one you do. It probably won't be the 10th one you do.
No.
But at some point, you will get there.
And I'll also say, like, letting an animal hard hang long enough to stiffen up before you start really breaking it down. And when you're going to cut your cuts, that meat needs to be cold.
Oh, yeah.
That mean, like, everything just, like, I remember the first time that we had a deer in camp and we wanted to eat tenderloin that night for dinner, and we took the tenderloins out of the back. We had it hanging, but it was still warm, and they came out just sloppy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next deer we shot, you know, we let it hang, and when you took them out, like, you almost didn't need a knife. You could just, like, slide your fingers behind them and cut both ends and pull, right? And it came out beautiful. And that made an impact on me. And, like, you're cutting steaks or whatever, or chops. When you have that meat cold and hard, you just get these beautiful slices. And when it's soft and floppy,
you're wedging everything, and it's, yeah.
And I mentioned
all the hunters out there,
you know, sausage and grinding, saving things. If you do not par freeze meat before you put that in a grinder, you hate yourself, and you are punishing yourself for no good reason. Mm-hmm. Like, you hate yourself. You really do. It comes out like booger snot instead of ground meat, you know?
Trust me, I'm in the middle of bear season. Have you ever tried to grind bear? It sucks. One thing I will say to all the hunters out there, listen, I know it's camp tradition to pull the tenderloins out and toss them on there. Don't do it. Leave it until you are either processing that animal yourself or until you bring it to the processor. Because guess what? What you can see of the tenderloin in that deer is not the whole tenderloin.
Yep.
You're leaving 2 to 3 inches of it up into the hind leg. So if you want the whole tenderloin, wait a day.
Yep.
Wait until that animal's cold, pop the flanks off, get it out of the back hams. Then you'll get a whole piece of tenderloin this big instead of five guys trying to split this much tenderloin.
You want to eat something the day you drop the animal. The heart's coming out anyway. Slice it up.
Exactly. Cook the heart, cook the liver, go to town.
Yeah, I agree. That's always my deer camp thing, is heart with just salt and pepper on the grill. And don't make well-done heart. You've sinned against meat, you've sinned against the animal, you've sinned against food. If you cook heart well done, it's very dense muscle. There's
no fat
in it.
If you cook anything with a hoof well done, there's a special place for you in hell.
Yes, there is. I think they have a whole room just for that, right?
Right.
Sinned against meat right there, right? Sinned against rumination.
They sit in a room in hell, and all they're doing is eating steak-flavored chewing gum. That's all they're doing.
For eternity. I would say, like, another thing that I would tell people that are going to get into processing is find out all the equipment you need and make the investment, right?
Yeah.
At least in halfway decent approximations. I understand you don't want to go spend a ton of money if you're not sure you can keep doing it, but, like, little things, like, we pick up roadkill here even though it's illegal because I found out nobody cares. So once nobody cares about something that's illegal, it's not illegal anymore.
It's not illegal anymore.
I don't have a proper processing facility, so I have a shop. And as simple as knowing, hey, I know this animal's been gutted. I know it's been bled out, but it's still going to bleed. And throwing, like, a big piece of cardboard under where you hang it from the rafters, that will make your life a little bit easier when it comes to cleaning up. Good quality knives. Know how to sharpen them. If you really aren't great at sharpening knives, get somebody to do it before you go to like a sharp knife is everything.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Like, have the equipment you need. If you have a place where you handle a gambrel, buy a gambrel. They're freaking cheap. Like, it's not going to work for a cow, but like a deer, a pig, a sheep, something like that.
You can pick them up at Walmart this time of year for $10. It is, you can do a sheep, a deer, a pig on those. What I will say, I do want to step back on what you said about, like, with sharpening knives and having sharp knives. If you are going to be doing this a lot, again, like you said, spend the money. Spend the money on a good set of knives, and when you order those knives, scoot on right over to Amazon or wherever the hell you're buying them from. Buy yourself a nice tri-stone sharpener and learn how to sharpen your knives. It is the most important thing humanly possible when it comes to processing an animal. If you have a dull knife, you will cut yourself because you're expending way more effort into actually making those cuts and doing everything because your knife's not sharp enough. If your knife's sharp enough, all you need is a sharp knife and a little bit of gravity, and everything comes apart and there's no problem.
And I'll add on sharpeners, like, so there's sharpeners and there's honers. So a steel is for honing. Yes. And what steels do is keep the knife from getting dull. Mm-hmm. And learn to use a steel too, because you don't have time to be sitting down there completely reestablishing an edge in the middle of a processing job. And I keep multiple knives of the same pattern.
Yep.
So when I'm working an animal and like this knife starts to get a little bit dull and I'm covered in blood and pig grease or whatever, I just put it down before I take it down to where it needs to go back on the stone, mm-hmm. pick up another one, and somewhere in between when I clean my hands up, then I'll put all of those knives back on the steel and continue. And that, like, a good, like, 6-inch boning knife from Victorinox, they're like $25, right? I mean, like, and it's, I know you know that knife because, like, most professionals use that knife, right?
I used to go through one every 6 months.
Okay.
Because so, I would sharpen it right before I walked into the shop for the day.
Yep.
And I would sharpen it right before I went back in the shop for lunch.
Got it.
Because when you're breaking down 3 or 4 beef a day.
Oh, yeah.
You need that knife sharp.
That's a lot of work. But, like, if you have two of them, you can get through a deer or a pig or a lamb, and you don't even have to hone. If one starts to stops cutting, you just go to the next one.
Right.
What do you think are some important things to think about for doing on-farm processing if you wanted to do kind of, like, for other people or even for yourself, I guess?
So the biggest thing to think about is – for me, at least, and I tell this to everyone, you need to think about where that deed is going to happen.
Okay.
Like, you need to whether it's you're processing the animal yourself or you have a butcher coming out to process that animal, you need to have a spot adjacent to where that animal's being held that is a smaller, confined area, whether that be a stall, whether that be a corral. Like, on all of my paddocks now, I have a small corral that is the entry and the exit point for every animal that goes into that system. Like, so if I'm putting new pigs into the system, they have to go in. If I have pigs coming out of the system to go either to the shop or they're being sold, they have to go out of there. And what that does is it makes your life or the butcher's life way easier. Because again, God forbid there's a missed shot, or God forbid, like, you're having a hard time getting that animal, instead of all of a sudden trying to take a shot on an animal in a quarter acre or a half an acre, whatever, you're taking a shot in a 12 by 12 area where that pig, regardless if it's freaked out or doing something like something squirrely, it's going to stop for a minute because it's going to assess its area. It's going to assess what's going on. It's going to give you the opportunity to make that shot.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then other than that, it's just have the best setup you possibly can for what you have available. If you got an oak tree in the yard, toss a rope and a pulley on it, you're good to go. If you got a tractor, fantastic. But it's anyone can do it. We've been doing this forever. The only job that's as old as being a butcher is being a prostitute, and we still got them too. So listen, anyone can do this.
Yeah, I would agree. I do think it is important to think about, like, if you plan on self-processing and you have livestock that you're caring for, to essentially train them to go places is kind of what you're saying there, so that when it's time to do the thing and I need the animal over here, I can just bring the animal over here. Like, one of the animals that we've processed on farm that was a little bit hard to do because they were so much wanting to hang out with you, I guess is the way I put it, is the damn gone turkeys.
Oh yeah.
But like, yeah, the turkey walks up to you and you're like, what? And the other ones are like, huh, am I next? Like, they just don't, it doesn't.
What's Jim doing?
Right. But it made it easy because I didn't have to like go, like when we do ducks, what I'll actually do is build a chute. And because I don't ever want to slaughter, I don't do meat runs. I'm doing culls. No. Like, yeah, we've got so many males now that the girls are starting to have bald spots on their necks, right? We got to cull some drakes. So we need to go through them. So we'll build, like, this corral out of hog panels with hardware cloth on it so they can't slip through. And as they come out, we'll have to catch them and, like, okay, you get to live, you go in the box. You get to live, right. You get to live, go in the box. And it's complicated, and it also kind of puts them in a stressful situation. Right. And in that situation, there's not really a way around it. But if there's a way to make that animal's last moments to where they don't even know, there's no stress,
right.
That's going to be better because you're not pumping stress hormones into the system. And honestly, if I'm going to kill something, I don't want it to suffer. I don't want it to be scared. I think one of the best ways in the world to do pigs is give them a bowl with a beer and a bowl of grain with soaked in beer.
I knew
and
a guy.
Last bite.
I knew a guy that would, from the day he got his feeders, every time he went in to feed them, he had a piece. I don't think it was copper. It was just a piece of pipe.
Okay.
Every day when he would go in to feed, he'd lay out the feed, and every pig, he'd walk up and he'd poke them right in the forehead. Okay. Every day. He'd poke every single pig in the forehead as they're feeding. And he'd do it over and over again. So then 7 months later, it's like, all right, put the feed down.
Yep.
Bonk, boom. Like, they don't know it's a different pipe. They just know that they get bonked in the head every time when they feed.
Yeah. You mentioned Self-Reliance Festival. You're going to be up there. I'll see you next week.
Absolutely.
I think you'll be there earlier than I am. I'm getting in Friday afternoon for the weekend
part. I'm getting in Thursday because I'm going to be going to Tim's work day. But, yeah, I'll be doing three different rabbit classes, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then I'll be running around. My wife has released me onto the East Coast, so everybody watch out. I'm trying to follow down to SRF. So I'm going to be beep-bopping around doing a whole bunch of stuff. So
is there anything you're particularly looking forward to while you're there?
I'm just excited to see everyone because, again, like, we create such a community on here with – doing the content and doing the YouTube that we make friends all over the country that we don't get to see until we do things like this. To where, like, I'm going out to New York on Monday to meet up with my podcast co-host, Joe Blakesley, and then him and his wife are also coming down. And again, Brian from The Lost Project, Tool Man Tim, I'm excited to see you again. Like, I haven't seen you since last year. So, that and I also have already talked to Fortress K9, and I'm getting in that bite suit. I've said it live here.
Now you got to do it.
Now I got to do it.
You know, having worked with one of his dogs now, I've had one of his dogs for about 2 years now, and having her once take me out not biting, I am more concerned with my knees about doing that from impact than actually the bite, because the suit's – if you do what he tells you and you keep your hands inside it,
you're fine.
It's very effective, yeah. The speed those animals move at, my girl's like 65 pounds, and that's not a very big dog.
They're fur missiles.
It's the velocity and
four
times mass, you know, or four times acceleration equals energy, you know, and it's the kinetic energy those animals have is insane. And until I owned one, I really didn't get their agility is stupid.
It's
like
crazy.
Absolutely stupid. Like when you go to try to grab one and they don't want, and they're like Muhammad Ali on steroids, man.
Of
like,
course.
Like Muhammad Ali on meth without the distortion meth causes. Like their reaction time is nuts. So good luck with that.
Yeah, it'll be fine. I'll be all right. It's all content now.
Are you going to do one dog or two dogs?
I'll do whatever he wants. Again, I am released from my earthly bonds for a week. Okay. I don't have to worry about getting milk for kids. I'm going to be at SRF doing basically whatever anyone says. If anyone goes, hey, you want to do this? I'll go, yeah, perfect. I'll do
that. You guys heard it.
You guys heard it.
There's like, still last-minute tickets.
Absolutely. Everybody go buy your tickets to SRF. And if you can't buy tickets to be there, definitely go buy the online stuff. Because everything we're doing is going to be filmed, and you can go look at it after the fact.
Yeah, but if you want to get Kyle to do stuff, you got to come in person.
Yes, if you want me to do stuff, you have to be there.
Let's take some questions first from not that kind of Karen. I love the handle. Question, please define custom exempt butcher is what she's asking. Custom exempt.
Yep. So a custom exempt butcher is essentially I am a contractor. That's essentially how that works. I am doing a service for a farmer or a hunter or something like that.
Okay.
All of my products are marked not for sale. They cannot be resold. Like we talked about earlier, you can't sell a steak that I cut.
Yeah.
But you are able to
immediately the steak that was perfectly safe will just kill you.
Right.
So if it gets resold, then you'll die, right?
Of course. Yeah. But again, kind of like what you said earlier, you can buy a half a pig live and then sign for all the paperwork to be able to, I'm processing that pig for you now. So now you are the farmer whose pig's getting processed. There's a bunch of loopholes that are a pain in the butt, but we make it work.
The same way that I buy a cow from the guy down the road. Okay. He takes it to the processor for me, and I split the cow with another guy. Right. In their case, they are state inspected, but it's the same. It's the same concept. Like
it's the same concept.
It's,
right.
It's status new jiu-jitsu is what it is. You know, Jeff Pointer says, and I'm not sure what angle because I didn't get an answer to my follow up. But if I wanted to start a business, why would it be a food production business? I don't know if he means like it's too much trouble or what's great about it.
Right. I mean. If you want me to be honest, there's not much great about it. It's a pain in the ass. But I almost don't even look at it like a food production business because I'm not producing. Like, I am somewhat. I do raise my own livestock and stuff like that. But 99% of the time, I am doing a service. So I look at myself more as almost like a plumber, where it's like you're hiring me to do something that I have a specific skill set for, which is – popping your animal in the head, putting it in the steaks, freezing it, and giving it back to you in retail cuts. So, again, like, if I know some people that have later in life that haven't been doing a bunch of processing, been like, hey, this will be a great idea. I'll start a butcher shop. And it's like, not a great idea. That's not going to be super fun for you unless you have a ton of money to throw at it.
Yeah. Hosgis says, what was the most exotic animal you've ever butchered, if any?
Honestly, it's probably a toss-up between – again, it's a very jaded answer because most people would be like, you've cut up black bear? Most people would be shocked by that. That's just par for the course for me now. Yeah. Probably the weirdest thing, it's a tie between snapping turtle and woodchuck. The woodchuck was my favorite, though. The first animal to go through our butcher shop was a woodchuck. And that was because before we had all the fences and everything up, we had a woodchuck that was screwing around. I had a buddy come up. He's the one who helped me build the shop. So literally everything was just sheathed plywood. We had the woodchuck. We didn't have anything else in the shop. Like, we were still in the process of building it. And we had had a couple pops, and we were out in the back porch, and finally this woodchuck showed up, and I had a .22 ready. And I was like, had too many pops, probably not going to hit that. My buddy goes, give that to me. Right through in one ear, out the other. We full on, we dragged it. We could have picked it up. We didn't. We dragged it to the butcher shop. We took some copper wire from doing the electrical work, made a gambrel. Put that thing on a gambrel, brought the winch all the way down to the floor, brought it all the way up.
Oh, my God.
Oh, we did everything. Broke it all down. There's video out there 15 somewhere.
15-pound animal, and you're using a winch on it, right?
We just built a butcher shop.
We got to use it.
Yeah, we're going to use it. It was actually delicious. We took the back hams and the back straps, and we were having a barbecue later that week, so I tossed them in the like a brine with cilantro and a whole bunch of other stuff, smoked them. We were also already smoking pork back fat.
Yeah.
Took all that pork back fat after it had smoked for a while, put in a container on the smoker, and then put that woodchuck into the pork fat. So we essentially confit brined woodchuck. And it was one of the most amazing things
I've
ever
had. It's good, isn't it? Like, I think it's amazing. I ate a lot of them when I was a kid because we shot them, and it was when we got permission to hunt. So we'd go, we'd take, you know, 22-250 or something and go out to the farms, and we would, you know, June, July, you go out there and shoot woodchucks for farmers. And then when you ask if you can hunt, they're like, sure. Cause everybody else goes like 2 weeks before deer season are like, the fuck out of here. Right. And I grew up poor, so you didn't throw meat away. But all, what we would do, we'd hang them up. We didn't use a winch, but we would hang them up. Like, I'd have two nails into the joist of the cellar, and I would just skin them down. And we did pretty much what you would do. We'd take the hams and the back strap.
Yeah.
And we'd just, you know, just cut through the ribs and just take that whole piece. And then we would break that into like three pieces, like the saddle and the two legs. And we always threw them in a pressure cooker for like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And then just grilled them like you were making pork shoulder or something. And it's damn good. I feel the exotic thing, though, because like I feel like about those like you do about bear. Like I did it all the time, so it's not exotic anymore.
Well, like, I mean, and again, it's geographical, too. Yeah. Like a ton of people process snap and turtle down south. Up here, we have a very limited season, and I've done a handful. Also delicious, a ton of work. And I see the comment down there, several different types of meat.
Yeah.
Yes and no. It's all turtle. It's all turtle. That would be like saying that a cow has however many different types of meat, depending on where it is. It's
or just when you fillet, if you fillet a pike or a muskie, you end up with seven different pieces. It's still all
right. It's pike or muskie. Just because turtles are built like tanks in really weird ways that people go, oh, there's seven different types of meat. It's like no, it's all turtle. You just got to cook the piss out of it.
This show that I watched one time, it was one of these like reality shows, and they were showing how people handle things like that. And it was these rednecks in Florida and the Seminole Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And the rednecks, you know, you're taking a snapping turtle apart and you're using bolt cutters and all this shit. And the Seminole Indians like kill the turtle. They turn it upside down and throw it in the fire.
Yeah.
They cook it in a shell. They roasted it till the shell got brittle. They pull it out. They hit it with a rock. And they just pulled all the meat out of it. They show this video to these rednecks, and they're like, some bitch. Like it never occurred to them.
I will say,
hit it with a rock. You know?
Like, I will say, you're in for a muddy meal if you do that. Because I go all out. I have them in a water trough for at least a week, replacing the water every day to purge everything out of it. And then I'll pop them, and how I do it is I'll stand on either side of them with my boots so they're not going to move at all. Yeah, and you just take a 2x4 and you just tap them on the nose a little bit so their head recedes back in. Like, what the hell is this? And then one of those taps, you just swing for the fences and it conks them out, doesn't kill them, but that gives you the opportunity to, one, make sure that definitely knocked them out, get a pair of channel locks in there and take the old noggin off. But even then, like, then I'll usually put them in an ice bath for like a day.
Okay.
Like, and then go through the whole process. Cause if you don't, you are going to get scratched the hell up because it's a reptile and they still move for a good long time after that head's gone.
Yeah. I'm trying to think like, how would I answer this question? I would say like the most exotic thing that people think of as exotic game would be like a black buck antelope.
But
that was literally a little deer.
Yeah.
There was nothing unique about it. I've done a lot of frog.
I haven't done any frog. A lot of
frog, and there's nothing complicated about it, but I guess that's unusual or something like, you know. But
well, listen, I've got a list. I've got a bucket list. When I finally make it down to Texas, I'm just going to start. I'm just going to start checking stuff off my list. I can't wait.
How we used to do frogs, like we would just take like a fly, like a fishing fly, but with a treble hook. Wired to it, and then we would just like you spot them with a light and you just dangle it in front of them and then they'll grab it, but then you've got this like, crazy
you end up with a treble hook in your hand because you're trying to grab a frog.
No you don't do that shit. Once you get control of them, you give them a whack. You don't grab a frog with a treble hook. That's bad news. But it saved a lot of like late. You go out fishing for catfish and like you're not catching any and you hear more wrong. More wrong. Yes, and then somebody inevitably on like their fifth beer goes, hey, I got an idea.
Right.
That's the guy you let take the hook out.
Exactly.
Right. But yeah, that's how I'd answer it. I mean, legit, I guess, would be black buck. And I've done an owl dad, but that was just like a big deer. There's nothing different about it. Canadian Farmstead says, why is the Cooney the best homestead pig?
He's baiting me. He's baiting me, Jack.
That's
I have. God damn it.
There's a backstory here.
Oh, there's an absolute backstory. I have a social media disdain for Cooney Coonies.
Okay.
I really have no problem with them as an actual pig. Yeah. But, of course, through content, I have to make things funny, and making fun of Cooney Coonies is a great way to do that. As a producer, I hate them. As a processor, I hate them.
Yeah.
They're fatty little suckers that take 16 months to get there. But depending on where you are, again, geographically, Cooney Coonies are a fantastic pig. If you have a lot of vast pasture that you don't want rooted up, you can set a bunch of Cooney Coonies loose, and they will just munch all day long. No trips to the feed store because they're just going to town. And again, you can put ruminants behind them because they're not tearing up the ground.
I don't know much about them. They're like small, really furry things, aren't they?
Yeah, they have the really short faces.
Okay.
They've become TikTok famous because they're adorable. Okay. And I get that. They're fine. But they're, like, you have to think they're a lard-producing pig. When you process them, the pork chops are like this. Most processors will not take them anymore. They will not take Coonies. They won't take American Guinea Hogs. Because
they sound similar in some ways to guinea hog. Like
guinea
hogs are delicious.
They are.
Some of them, but like you're getting half lard.
Yes, that's it. That's
and 18 months.
Yes. It's for bang for the buck. It's not worth it. Yeah. Canadian Farmstead has some wonderful pigs. They look fantastic. And whenever he processes them, they look great. And he'll have plenty of fat to cook them in.
Yeah. Yeah. what is your favorite meat to process and cook?
Probably pigs. I always joke that my autism's in pigs because I can just go on for hours about them. But I love breaking them down because, one, they're very easy, but also they're all different. Like, depending on the breed, you're going to have very different muscle structure and marbling and stuff like that. And, again, when it comes to cooking them, I'll take a pork steak, like a pork shoulder steak over a ribeye any day of the week.
I have to say, if I have to start with a full animal, a deer, because it's easy.
Yeah, that's
true.
When
it comes to making cuts, if you're already down to primals, probably for me it's beef. It's big enough that it's easy to work with. But I'm with you on the pigs, man. Like, whenever I buy pork shoulder, because I'm going to make sausage or something, there's always like half of the, capricola.
Yes.
Right? There's like half of it still in there. I always pull that out, man, and make steaks out of that. Like, you know.
Well, I love processing beef because you're doing something.
Yeah.
Like on my beef processing days, I'm working because, again, I don't have a rail system in my shop. I'm throwing around 500 pounds of beef that day or 700 pounds of beef, whatever I'm doing. And it's like, I'm working, I'm doing stuff, and I love it. But I do love breaking down pigs. They're fun.
Yeah. Let's see. Matthew says, for a ground up built for personal on-farm processing shed, big enough for a beef, how big and what would be the must-haves and the nice-to-haves?
All right. that's a bit of a loaded one. All right. Yeah. Doesn't have to be huge. Like, you just need to have an area in your shop, probably. I mean, you can make it just your shop area. You can get by with a, I don't know, 15 by 15 area, not including a walk-in. If you're going to be breaking down beef, you need a walk-in. I hate to say it that way. Like, you can cut it hot. Like, if you want to go through the process of cutting it hot, which I, as a professional, do not suggest because it's not fun. And your walk-in doesn't have to be massive. Like, your walk-in can be, to fit a decent size, like 700-pound hang weight animal, you can get by with a 10 by 10 walk-in.
Yeah.
Like, and hang it comfortably in there. If you're planning on processing beef, number one, walk-in cooler. Two is a grinder that is above I'm going to say a horse and like 1.5 horse to 2 horse.
Like bracket. A number 32 up.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Spend the money.
If you don't have to worry grinder. About your arm going into it, you get the wrong grinder.
Exactly. Exactly. That is the one thing I always tell people. Splurge on the grinder. You can cheap out on some other stuff. Splurge on your grinder. It's going to be worth it. You're going to thank me in the end. Yeah, that's pretty much what I would say. And a good cut bench.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely on that. Lovecroft says, is there a shopping list resource for must-haves just starting on-farm personal process? And we've kind of hit here and there.
We kind of hit it. Again, just good knives, bone saw, get yourself a bone saw. Buy the LEM ones. Don't go to Cabela's and buy those ones. They are junk. They, for whatever reason, they changed manufacturers, and their bone saws are not worth it.
Let me re-emphasize what you're saying about grinders. So I've always done 10, 15 pounds of grind out of shot a few times a year here and there. Or, you know, you get a deer and you end up with 7 pounds of grind and maybe you throw 3 pounds of pork with it for fat.
Right.
And I have this little STX turbo grinder, about $150.
Yep.
It's always been more than enough. I just made over the past 3 weeks 75 pounds of sausage. The next investment I'm making is a bigger grinder.
Yes.
Right. And I'm never doing this again until I get a bigger grinder. Like I said, I want something that you have to have a guard because if you stick your arm in there, it's going to eat your arm.
Yeah.
It just, you know, you spend $200 less and you get like $1,000 less in performance.
Oh, I've got a 250-pound capacity Hobart, and that thing is a monster. And of course, you've rednecked it that none of the safety features work. It run if the foot pedal's on, it runs. So do not stick your hand in there or else you're going
for a ride. It'll eat your fingers right off. Right?
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah.
Gone. If you're making sausage, what I've run into is I got a demo model from Vavor.
Mm-hmm.
It worked beautifully the first time, and it literally broke the second time I used it.
Yeah.
Since they gave it to me, I can't bitch and say, give me another one. Right? If I bought it, it would be in a different story. So then I'm like, well, I'm going to buy a large capacity, like a 30-pound manual one and see how they work. And I'm like, I'm not buying from Vavor, even though I work with them. And then I looked at all of them and bought one from Vavor because they're all the same.
Right.
They're all at the consumer level. I don't care if it's Cabela's, LEM. They're all
exactly the same.
The meat company, whatever. They're all the same. And I did a deep dive on it, and I'll probably never make the investment to go up because, like, the stuff that probably somebody like you would use or above, they're like start at like $4,000.
Oh, yeah.
And they use hydraulics.
Yeah.
Because what happens is the gearing fails or the pressure plate fails in these things because I don't think people get in their head how much freaking pressure it takes when you're taking meat in a tub that's, you know, 8, 10, 12 inches in diameter and putting it through a half-inch tube. It's a tremendous amount of pressure. And I'll give Vivor this. I bought, it's basically the same size as the electric one, except it's manual crank.
Mm-hmm.
Flawless. Like I said, I made 75 pounds with it over the last 3 weeks and no problems whatsoever. But on hand crank ones, you either need that thing bolted down or you need you put 30 pounds of sausage in a stuffer. Your first half of that's easy.
Oh, yeah.
But it's heavy. And as it loses weight, what somebody needs to invent is a ratchet handle.
Yeah,
that would actually be pretty smart. So that when you're starting to come up, you can just ratchet back around because you're not pulling it off and resetting. Because when you're pushing down, it's easy.
That's your next investment.
It really helped to have somebody with you. But then you get into the whole communication thing, right? Like,
right. When you're making sausage with somebody, or somebody you know is making sausage with somebody, and you walk into the room and you're not paying attention, that could be a very interesting conversation you're walking into.
Yeah.
Or it's just like, faster, nope, slow it down.
Now, if I could find this, we used to do all our sausage when I was a kid for deer sausage. We went over to this farmer that we knew. His name was Snokey. I don't know his real name. And he had this thing. It looked like something you could crush people's heads in. It was probably good. Barely get your arms around it. And it looked like it did fruit and sausage, honestly.
Yeah.
And it had a big wheel on the top of it. And you could turn that thing with one finger.
Mm-hmm. They made them better back in the day.
And he would just, he'd sit there and feed it, and I'd turn it, and we never had no trouble because it was so smooth.
Yeah.
But it was probably, it was the 80s, and it was probably 100 years old if it was a day back right. then, right? So it's probably from like the 1880s or something. And they just don't build those things anymore like that.
No, they don't.
I'm even trying to find antiques on like eBay, and unless you want to like take it to a restoration shop or something, they're rusted or whatever.
Exactly.
So I got one more question, Kyle, and then we'll let you go. I bet you there's some backstory to this one, too. Is Kyle going to do stand-up comedy at SRF? LOL.
To my knowledge, probably not. I haven't asked Nicole. There is a little bit. So I'm still doing quite a bit of content. I just haven't been doing much on YouTube. I've definitely, and again, you know this, doing content as much as you have to where it's like, you go in different veins of what you're looking for. I do enjoy doing the informational stuff. I do enjoy giving a bunch of information to help people. But I literally just broke 1,000 followers on YouTube.
Okay.
I'm at over 20,000 followers on TikTok.
Okay.
I have thoroughly enjoyed the entertaining aspect of doing content much more than doing the informational. Just because, listen, I've been a butcher. I've been in the meat industry for 14 years. I've got a dark sense of humor. I'm a farmer. There are so many things that happen in both of these lines of work that are absolutely insane, and the only way to really get through them is to find the humor in it, to be funny with it.
Yeah.
And I've been feeding into that a lot. We've had some stand-up comedians from – based out of New York, or now they're in Texas, but they came up and filmed a bunch of content up here. And I'm kind of trying to turn my property into an area where it's like, hey, all these stand-up comedians that I thoroughly enjoy that I've been listening to for a decade, you need extra content. Hey, I have a 14-acre playground with a butcher shop and a bunch of pigs that all these city slickers can come up and do a whole bunch of shit. And it's fun. It's fun because normal people, like, I've accepted the fact I'm not normal. I'm not normal in any facet of life.
I've seen normal and I have no interest in it.
Exactly. Neither do I. But I can make it funny. Like, there's just whatever about me as a person, how I've grown up and what I do for a living, I am able to find the funny in it. And I'm usually able to find the funny in it and deliver it in a very deadpan way where it's like, is he serious? Oh, shit. Like, on TikTok recently, I've just been doing a bunch of, like, basically responses to what vegans have said to me, like, on TikTok and comments or on lives and stuff like that, and then just hitting them back with your mama jokes. It's the funniest thing in the world to me, and I absolutely love it. But, yeah, I've had a bunch of people tell me I need to try to start doing stand-up and everything like that, and I'm like, I don't know. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out as it goes along.
So Houston slid one more question in, and I don't even know what it is. Are IPP worth considering?
Idaho Pasture Pigs, same vein. You're talking about the same thing. Tuny Coonies, Idaho Pasture Pigs, Guinea Hogs, depending on where you are.
All of that shit.
Yeah. If you're in an area with a lot of grazing, they're great.
I think people need to understand how those pigs have traditionally been used for meat. And then maybe they wouldn't be so inane on doing it. So, like, Vietnam, the potbelly pig is a main staple meat source. Mm-hmm. But, like, they have these villages, and the freaking pigs just run in and around the village. They feed them scraps and shit. They go up in the hills. They come down. And every once in a while, like, pig? I got a pig. Right? And then that pig goes, right?
Well,
guineas come out of Appalachia, and these farmers just basically train the pigs by feeding them a little bit, like dogs. And they leave every day and come back, and then they kill them in, like, the second season when the mass drop is about consumed. And so they have no work into the animal.
Exactly.
So it works where if you're going to, like, have a small piece of land, you don't have 800 acres for these animals to run around eating freaking, nuts on or something like that fall out of the tree.
They're not a sedentary animal. Like, they become sedentary animals very quickly because they gain so much fat. But again, like, thinking about it from, like, even if you're looking at it from, like, a being preparedness standpoint, Yeah, maybe get into some pot bellies, but even that, I would go look at Ospa Island Hogs for that, because if you're looking at a survival situation where, listen, I don't have a freezer, I don't have power, I still yeah. want meat with pigs, you're not going to be raising these animals to 300 pounds.
Yeah.
You're going to be producing a lot of piglets.
Yeah.
You're going to have a couple breeders to be able to breed those animals, and hey, guess what? When they're this big, you're going to walk out and go, shoink, done. Yeah. And yeah. now we have food for the next 2 days.
Yeah. yeah.
And then in 2 or 3 days, you're going to go, hey, come here, little pig.
Another one. Yep. Yeah. yeah.
That's what you're going to do. You're not going to be putting the time and effort into a 300-pound animal. So
no.
it's different scenarios warrant different critters.
If you want to do that in South Texas, you buy a piece of land.
Yeah.
Near Peter. You surround it with freaking hog panels so they can't knock it over.
Right.
You lay up a couple of IBCs full of corn,
mm-hmm.
and you feed them corn once a day. And whenever you want one, you pop one. And you don't
exactly.
buy any pigs.
You
don't care what breed they are. They're pigs, right? They're feral. They're whatever
yeah.
they are. And what that's what I'm kind of getting at. These breeds like Potbellies and Guineas and these other ones I'm less familiar with. That's basically what they were, like, semi-domesticated.
Right.
They were not feral, but they were more like kept like the stray dog that shows up on your farm and you kind of like him, but you don't let him in the house.
Right.
That's kind of
yeah.
how they had that going on.
Well, see, that's what's cool about the Ospas is it's like they were a domesticated pig,
okay.
and then they were dropped off on Ospa Island out off the coast of Georgia by the Spanish when they were coming to conquer the New World, and then they just evolved there for
yeah.
500 yeah. years. So I did see this. So my boar that I have right now, he is Mangalitsa, Ospa, Duroc, and Yorkshire.
Oh, wow.
We bred them to our Herefords, and these pigs
yeah.
are freaking studs.
Yeah.
They are absolute studs. I timed farrowing wrong, so now I'm going into winter with a whole bunch of piglet. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm going into winter with 7. I currently
okay.
have 12.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend I'm in an apocalypse and just go, shrink, take a couple of those guys, put them in the freezer. Exactly.
They're kind of perfect for, like, a spin.
I'm going to quarter them.
Or
I'm literally going to split them in quarter them.
Do you know what a Cajachina is?
Yeah.
Right? They're just kind of a perfect yeah. Cajachina size, right?
Exactly.
If you don't know what a Cajachina is, we're not going to tell you. You'll have to look it
nope.
up.
Sure
anyway,
not.
Anyway, Kyle, I really appreciate. Some people speak Spanish and they know what the word is. They still don't know what it means. You'll have to work it out. Hey, anyway, man, I appreciate you being with us today.
Absolutely, my friend. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks, real quick before I go, I just want to wrap up and remind you that you can always help support the show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com, where you can find those Victorinox knives that we were talking about, sharpeners and all that. But what's on sale this week, and it still is as of this morning, and I really don't know how long these things are going to stay on sale. The Excalibur 2900 Series 9 Tray Dehydrators are on sale for $169. The world of dehydrators, there's Excalibur and there's everything else. Everything else is freaking consumer-level garbage. If you want something better than this, you're moving into, like, professional, high-quality, commercial-level stuff. These things normally sell for about $2.50. Again, they're on sale for $169. Excalibur doesn't do this often. Everything in me, all my marketing spider sense is telling me this unit is being discontinued because it's the least expensive of the Excalibur line, and they're clearing it out, and that's why it stayed on sale this long, because the last time this thing was marked down under $170 was 2020. That's almost 4 years. So if you need to add an Excalibur dehydrator to your life, I would do it now. We're into the harvest season. All the stuff's coming in from the gardens. You got to do something with it. This is the way. And if you like to make jerky, it's great for that too. With that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up and cut the end segment short today. I will let you know, tomorrow will be an expert council Q&A, then Friday flashback, week normal this week. Next week is going to be a mix of, we're going to have a rewind on Monday because I'm getting ready to leave here. Tuesday, I got a live with John and Nicole. Wednesday, I got a rewind. Thursday, we will have expert counsel because, I don't know, something happened. The expert counsel is just throwing content at me. So I'm going to get that done today. And then Friday next week, we'll have a flashback. And the following Monday, we'll have a rewind as well because I'll be getting back Monday, and I'm just not going to have time to put it together. Then we'll return to regularly scheduled programming. Anyway, guys, thanks for tuning in with me and Kyle today. Have a great night. Just
run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.